Oh, said Sansa.
I'm talking to him, and he's touching me. He's holding my arm and touching me.
The Queen of Thorns, she's called, isn't that right? It is, Sir Loras laughed.
He has the warmest laugh,
she thought as he went on. You'd best not use that name in her presence, though, or you'll like to get pricked. Sansa reddened. Any fool would have realized that no woman could be happy about being called the Queen of Thorns.
Maybe I truly am as stupid as Cersei Lannister says.
Desperately, she tried to think of something clever and charming to say to him, but her wits had deserted her. She almost told him how beautiful he was, until she remembered she'd already done that.
He was beautiful, though. He seemed taller than he had been when she first met him, but still so lithe and graceful, and Sansa had never seen another boy with such wonderful eyes. He's no boy, though. He's a man grown, a knight of the King's Guard.
She thought he looked even finer in white than in the green and golds of House Tyrell. The only spot of colour in him now was the brooch that clasped his cloak. The rose of Highgarden, wrought in soft yellow gold, nestled in a bed of delicate green jade leaves. Sir Balin Swan held the door of Maegor's for them to pass. He was all in white as well, though he did not wear it half so well as Sir Loras. Beyond the spiked moat, 2 dozen men were taking their practice with sword and shield. With the castle so crowded, the outer ward had been given over to guests to raise their tents and pavilions, leaving only the smaller inner yards for training. One of the Red Wine twins was being driven backward by Sir Talad, with the eyes on his shield. Chunky Sir Kennis of Case, who chuffed and puffed every time he raised his longsword, seemed to be holding his own against Usni Kettleblack. But Usni's brother, Sir Osfrid, was savagely punishing the frog-faced squire, Morris Slint. Blunted swords or no, Slint would have a rich crop of bruises by the morrow. It made Sansa wince just to watch. They have scarcely finished burying the dead from the last battle, and already they are practicing for the next one. On the edge of the yard, a lone knight with a pair of golden roses on his shield was holding off 3 foes. Even as they watched, he caught one of them alongside the head, knocking him senseless.
"Is that your brother?" Sansa asked.
"It is, my lady," said Sir Loras. "Garden often trains against 3 men, or even 4. In battle, it is seldom 1 against 1, he says, so he likes to be prepared."
"He must be very brave."
"He is a great knight," Sir Loras replied. "A better sword than me, in truth, though I'm the better lance."
"I remember," said Sansa. "You ride wonderfully, sir."
"My lady is gracious to say so. When has she seen me ride?"
"At the Hand's Tourney, don't you remember? You rode a white courser, and your armour was 100 different kinds of flowers. You gave me a rose, a red rose. You threw white roses to the other girls that day."
It made her flush to speak of it.
"You said no victory was half as beautiful as me."
Sir Loras gave her a modest smile. "I spoke only a simple truth, that any man with eyes could see."
"He doesn't remember," Sansa realized, startled. "He's only being kind to me. He doesn't remember me, or the rose, or any of it." She had been so certain that it meant something, that it meant everything. A red rose, not a white.
"It was after you unhorsed Sir Robar Royce," she said desperately. He took his hand from her arm. "I slew Robar at Storm's End, my lady." It was not a boast. He sounded sad.
"Him and another, if King Renly's Rainbow Guard as well, yes." Sansa had heard the women talking of it around the well, but for a moment she'd forgotten.
"That was when Lord Renly was killed, wasn't it? How terrible for your poor sister."
"For Marjorie," his voice was tight.
"To be sure, she was at Bitterbridge, though. She did not see."
"Even so, when she heard—"
Sir Loras brushed the hilt of his sword lightly with his hand. Its grip was white leather, its pommel a rose in alabaster. Renly is dead. Robar as well. What use to speak of them?
The sharpness in his tone took her aback.
My lord, I did not mean to give offence, sir.
Nor could you, Lady Sansa, Sir Loras replied, but all the warmth had gone from his voice. Nor did he take her arm again. They ascended the serpentine steps in a deepening silence.
Why did I have to mention Sir Robar? Sansa thought. I've ruined everything. He is angry with me now.
She tried to think of something she might say to make amends, but all the words that came to her were lame and weak.
Be quiet, or you'll only make it worse, she told herself.
Lord Mace Tyrell and his entourage had been housed behind the royal sept in the long, slate-roofed keep that had been called the Maiden Vault, since King Baelor the Blessed had confined his sisters therein, so the sight of them might not tempt him into carnal thoughts. Outside its tall carved doors stood two guards in gilded half-helms and green cloaks edged in gold satin, the golden rose of Highgarden sewn on their breasts. Both were seven-footers, wide of shoulder and narrow of waist, magnificently muscled. When Sansa got close enough to see their faces, she could not tell one from the other. They had the same strong jaws, the same deep blue eyes, the same thick red moustaches.
"Who are they?" she asked Sir Loras, her discomfort forgotten for a moment.
"My grandmother's personal guard," he told her. "Their mother named them Eric and Arik, but grandmother can't tell them apart, so she calls them Left and Right." Left and Right opened the doors, and Margaery Tyrell herself emerged and swept down the short flight of steps to greet them. "Lady Sansa," she called, "I'm so pleased you came. Be welcome." Sansa knelt at the feet of her future queen.
"You do me great honour, Your Grace."
"Won't you call me Margaery? Please rise. Loras, help the Lady Sansa to her feet. Might I call you Sansa?"
"If it please you."
Sir Loras helped her up. Margaery dismissed him with a sisterly kiss and took Sansa by the hand. "Come, my grandmother awaits, and she is not the most patient of ladies." A fire was crackling in the hearth, and sweet-smelling rushes had been scattered on the floor. Around the long trestle table a dozen women were seated. Sansa recognized only Lord Tyrell's tall, dignified wife, Lady Ellery, whose long silvery braid was bound with jewelled rings. Margaery performed the other introductions. There were three Tyrell cousins, Megha and Alla and Eleanor, all close to Sansa's age. Buxom Lady Janna was Lord Tyrell's sister and wed to one of the Greenapple Fussaways. Dainty, bright-eyed Lady Leonette was a Fussaway as well and wed to Sir Garlan. Septa Nysterica had a homely, puck-scarred face but seemed jolly. Pale, elegant Lady Graceford was with child, and Lady Bulwer was a child, no more than 8. And Mary was what she was to call boisterous plump Meredith Crane, but most definitely not Lady Merryweather, a sultry, black-eyed Moorish beauty. Last of all, Margaery brought her before the wizened, white-haired doll of a woman at the head of the table. "I am honoured to present my grandmother, the Lady Alina, widow to the late Luther Tyrell, Lord of Highgarden, whose memory is a comfort to us all." The old woman smelled of rose water.
"Why, she's just the littlest bit of a thing."
There was nothing the least bit thorny about her.
"Kiss me, child,"
Lady Alina said, tugging at Sansa's wrist with a soft spotted hand.
"It's so kind of you to sup with me and my foolish flock of hens."
Dutifully, Sansa kissed the old woman on the cheek. "It is kind of you to have me, my lady."
"I knew your grandfather, Lord Rickard, though not well."
"He died before I was born."
"I am aware of that, child. It's said that your Tully grandfather is dying too, Lord Huster. Surely they told you? An old man, though not so old as me. Still, night falls for all of us in the end, and too soon for some." You would know that more than most, poor child. You've had your share of grief, I know. We are sorry for your losses.
Sansa glanced at Margaery. I was saddened when I heard of Lord Renly's death, Your Grace. He was very gallant. You are kind to say so, answered Margaery. Her grandmother snorted.
Gallant, yes, and charming, and very clean. He knew how to dress, and he knew how to smile, and he knew how to bathe, and somehow he got the notion that this made him fit to be king. The Baratheons have always had some queer notions, to be sure, and it comes from their Targaryen blood, I should think. She sniffed. They tried to marry me to a Targaryen once, but I soon put an end to that.
Renly was brave and gentle, grandmother, said Margaery. Father liked him as well, and so did Loras.
Loras is young,
Lady Orlena said crisply,
and very good at knocking men off horses with a stick. That does not make him wise. As to your father, would that I had been born a peasant woman with a big wooden spoon. I might have been able to beat some sense into his fat head.
Mother, Lady O'Leary scolded.
Hush, O'Leary, and don't take that tone with me. And don't call me mother. If I'd given birth to you, I'm sure I'd remember. I'm only to blame for your husband, the Lord Oaf of Highgarden.
Grandmother, Margaery urged, mind your words, or what will Sansa think of us?
She might think we have some wits about us. One of us, at any rate.
The old woman turned back to Sansa.
It's treason. I warn them. Robert has two sons, and Renly has an older brother. How can he possibly have any claim to that ugly iron chair? Tut, tut, says my son. Don't you want your sweetling to be queen? You Starks were kings once, the Aerons and the Lannisters as well, and even the Baratheons through the female line, but the Tyrells were no more than Stuarts, until Aegon the Dragon came along and cooked the rightful king of the Reach on the Field of Fire. If truth be told, even our claim to Highgarden is a bit dodgy, just as those dreadful Florents are always whining. What does it matter, you ask? Well, of course it doesn't. Except to oaths, like my son. The thought that one day he may see his grandson with his arse on the Iron Throne makes Mace puff up like... Now, what do you call it? Margaery, you're clever. Be a dear, and tell your poor old half-daft grandmother the name of that queer fish from the Summer Isles, that puffs up to 10 times its own size when you poke it.
They call them pufffish, grandmother.
Of course they do. Summer Islanders have no imagination. My son ought to take the pufffish for his sigil. If truth be told, he could put a crown on it, the way the Baratheons do their stag. Mayhap that would make him happy. We should have stayed well out of all this bloody foolishness, if you ask me. But once the cow's been milked, there's no squirting the cream back up her udder. After Lord Pufffish put that crown on Renly's head, we were into the pudding up to our knees. So, here we are to see things through. And what do you say to that, Sansa?
Sansa's mouth opened and closed. She felt very like a pufffish herself. The Tyrells can trace their descent back to Garth Greenhand, was the best she could manage at short notice. The Queen of Thorns snorted.
Tchia! So can the Florents, the Rowans, the Oakharts, and half the other noble houses of the south. Garth liked to plant his seed in fertile ground, they say. I shouldn't wonder that more than his hands were green.
Sansa, Lady Lyra broke in, you must be very hungry. Shall we have a bite of boar together and some lemon cakes?
Lemon cakes are my favourite, Sansa admitted.
So we have been told, declared Lady Olenna,
who obviously had no intention of being hushed.
That Varys creature seemed to think we should be grateful for the information. I've never been quite sure what the point of a eunuch is, if truth be told. It seems to me they're only men, with the useful bits cut off. Eleri, will you have them bring the food, or do you mean to starve me to death? Here, Sansa, sit here, next to me. I'm much less boring than these others. I hope that you're fond of fools.
Sansa smoothed down her skirts and sat. I think... Fools, my lady. You mean the sort in motley?
Feathers, in this case. What do you imagine I was speaking of? My son? Or these lovely ladies? Now don't blush. With your hair, it makes you look like a pomegranate. All men are fools, if truth be told, but the ones in motley are more amusing than ones with crowns. Marjorie, child, summon Butterbumps. Let us see if we can't make Lady Sansa smile. The rest of you, be seated. Do I have to tell you everything? Sansa must think that my granddaughter is attended by a flock of sheep.
Butterbumps arrived before the food, dressed in a jester suit of green and yellow feathers with a floppy coxcomb. An immense round fat man, as big as three moon boys, he came cartwheeling into the hall, vaulted onto the table, and laid a gigantic egg right in front of Sansa.
"Break it, my lady," he commanded.
When she did, a dozen yellow chicks escaped and began running in all directions.
"Catch them!"
Butterbumps exclaimed. Little Lady Bulwer snagged one and handed it to him, whereby he tilted back his head, popped it into his huge rubbery mouth, and seemed to swallow it whole. When he belched, tiny yellow feathers flew out of his nose. Lady Bulwer began to wail in distress, but her tears turned into a sudden squeal of delight when the chick came squirming out of the sleeve of her gown and ran down her arm. As the servants brought forth a broth of leeks and mushroom, Butterbumps began to juggle, and Lady Alina pushed herself forward to rest her elbows on the table.
"Do you know my son, Sansa, Lord Pufffish of Highgarden?"
"A great lord," Sansa answered politely.
"A great oaf," said the Queen of Thorns. "His father was an oaf as well. My husband, the late Lord Lufa. Oh, I loved him well enough, don't mistake me. A kind man, and not unskilled in the bedchamber, but an appalling oaf, all the same. He managed to ride off a cliff whilst hawking. They say he was looking up at the sky and paying no mind to where his horse was taking him. And now my oaf son is doing the same, only he's riding a lion instead of a palfrey. It's easier to mount a lion, and not so easy to get off, I warned him. But he only chuckles. Should you ever have a son, Sansa, beat him frequently, so he learns to mind you. I only had the one boy, and I hardly beat him at all, so now he pays more heed to Butterbumps than he does to me. A lion is not a lap cat, I told him, and he gives me a tut-tut, mother. There is entirely too much tut-tutting in this realm, if you ask me. All these kings would do a great deal better if they put down their swords and listened to their mothers."
Sansa realized that her mouth was open again. She filled it with a spoon of broth, while Lady Illyria and the other women were giggling at the spectacle of Butterbumps bouncing oranges off his head, his elbows, and his ample rump.
"I want you to tell me the truth about this royal boy," said Lady Alina abruptly. "This Joffrey."
Sansa's fingers tightened around her spoon.
"The truth? I can't. Don't ask it, please. I can't.
You, yes. Who would know better? The dad seems kingly enough, I'll grant you. A bit full of himself, but that would be his Lannister blood. We've heard some troubling tales, however. Is there any truth to them? Has this boy mistreated you?"
Sansa glanced about nervously. Butterbumps popped a whole orange into his mouth, chewed and swallowed, slapped his cheek, and blew seeds out of his nose. The women giggled and laughed. Servants were coming and going, and the maiden vault echoed to the clatter of spoons and plates. One of the chicks hopped back onto the table and ran through Lady Grace Ford's broth. No one seemed to be paying them any mind, but even so, she was frightened. Lady Olena was growing impatient.
"Why are you gaping at Butterbumps? I asked a question. I expect an answer. Have the Lannisters stolen your tongue, child?"
Sir Dontus had warned her to speak freely only in the Guardswood.
"King Joffrey,
His Grace is very fair and handsome and as brave as a lion. Yes, all the Lannisters are lions, and when a Tyrell breaks wind, it smells just like a rose, the old woman snapped. But how kind is he? How clever? Has he a good heart, a gentle hand? Is he chivalrous as befits a king? Will he cherish Margaery and treat her tenderly, protect her honour as he would his own? He will, Sansa lied. He is very, very comely. You said that. You know, child, some say that you are as big a fool as Butterbumps here, and I am starting to believe them. Comely? I've taught my Margaery what comely is worth, I hope. Somewhat less than a mummer's fart. Arian Brightfire was comely enough, but a monster all the same. The question is, what is Joffrey? She reached to snag a passing servant. I am not fond of leeks. Take this broth away and bring me some cheese.
The cheese will be served after the cakes, my lady.
The cheese will be served when I want it served, and I want it served now. The old woman turned back to Sansa. Are you frightened, child? No need for that. We're only women here. Tell me the truth. No harm will come to you.
My father always told the truth. Sansa spoke quietly, but even so it was hard to get the words out.
Lord Eddard, yes, he had that reputation, but they named him traitor, and took his head off even so.
The old woman's eyes bore into her, sharp and bright as the points of swords.
Joffrey, Sansa said, Joffrey did that. He promised me he would be merciful, and cut off my father's head. He said that was mercy, and he took me up on the walls and made me look at it. The head. He wanted me to weep, but...
She stopped abruptly and covered her mouth.
I've said too much. Oh, gods be good, they'll know, they'll hear. Someone will tell on me.
Go on. It was Margaery who urged. Joffrey's own queen-to-be. Sansa did not know how much she had heard.
I can't. What if she tells him? What if she tells? He'll kill me for certain, then, or give me to Sir Ilion.
I never meant. My father was a traitor. My brother as well. I have the traitor's blood. Please, don't make me say any more.
Calm yourself, child, the Queen of Thorns commanded.
She's terrified, grandmother. Just look at her. The old woman called to Butterbumps.
Fool, give us a song. A long one, I should think. The bear and the maiden fair will do nicely.
It will, the huge jester replied. It will do nicely indeed. Shall I sing it standing on me head, my lady?
Will that make it sound better?
No.
Stand on your feet, then. We wouldn't want your hat to fall off. As I recall, you never wash your hair.
As my lady commands.
Butterbumps bowed low, let loose of an enormous belch, then straightened, threw out his belly, and bellowed.
A bear there was, a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair.
Lady Olena squirmed forward.
Even when I was a girl younger than you, it was well known that in the Red Keep the very walls have ears. Well, they will be the better for a song, and meanwhile we girls shall speak freely.
But, Sansa said, Varys, he knows, he always...
Sing louder, the Queen of Thorns shouted at Butterbumps. These old ears are almost deaf, you know. Are you whispering at me, you fat fool? I don't pay you for whispers. Sing!
The bear, thundered Butterbumps, his great deep voice echoing off the rafters. Oh, come, he said, oh, come to the fair. The fair, said he, but I'm a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair.
The wrinkled old lady smiled.
At Highgarden we have many spiders amongst the flowers. So long as they keep to themselves, we let them spin their little webs. But if they get underfoot, we step on them.
She patted Sansa on the back of the hand.
Now, child, the truth. What sort of man is this Joffrey, who calls himself Baratheon, but looks so very Lannister?
and down the road from here to there, from here to there, see boys, a goat and a dancing bear.
Sansa felt as though her heart had lodged in her throat. The Queen of Thorns was so close she could smell the old woman's sour breath. Her gaunt, thin fingers were pinching her wrist. To her other side, Margaery was listening as well. A shiver went through her.
"A monster," she whispered, so tremulously she could scarcely hear her own voice. "Joffrey is a monster. He lied about the butcher's boy and made father kill my wolf. When I displease him, he has the king's guard beat me. He's evil and cruel, my lady. It's so. And the queen as well."
Lady Olenna Tyrell and her granddaughter exchanged a look.
"Ah," said the old woman, "that's a pity."
"Oh, gods," thought Sansa, horrified. "If Margaery won't marry him, Joff will know that I'm to blame."
"Please," she blurted, "don't stop the wedding."
"Have no fear. Lord Pufffish is determined that Margaery shall be queen, and the word of a Tyrell is worth more than all the gold in Casterly Rock. At least it was in my day. Even so, we thank you for the truth, child."
"Danced and spun all the way to the fair, the fair, the fair."
Butterbumps hupped and roared and stumped his feet. "Sansa, would you like to visit Highgarden?" When Margaery Tyrell smiled, she looked very like her brother Loras. "All the autumn flowers are in bloom just now, and there are groves and fountains, shady courtyards, marble colonnades. My lord father always keeps singers at court, sweeter ones than butters here, and pipers and fiddlers and harpers as well. We have the best horses and pleasure boats to sail along the Mander. Do you hawk, Sansa?"
"A little," she admitted.
"Oh, sweet she was, and pure and fair, the maid with honey in her hair."
"You will love Highgarden, as I do, I know it." Margaery brushed back a loose strand of Sansa's hair. "Once you see it, you'll never want to leave. And perhaps you won't have to."
"Her hair, her hair, the maid with honey in her hair."
"Shush, child," the Queen of Thorns said sharply. "Sansa hasn't even told us that she would like to come for a visit."
"Oh, but I would," Sansa said. Highgarden sounded like the place she'd always dreamed of, like the beautiful, magical court she had once hoped to find at King's Landing.
"Smell the scent on the summer air, the bear, all black and brown and covered with air."
"But the queen," Sansa went on, "she won't let me go."
"She will. Without Highgarden, the Lannisters have no hope of keeping Joffrey on his throne. If my son, the Lord of Oath, asks, she will have no choice but to grant his request."
"Will he?" asked Sansa. "Will he ask?"
Lady Olenna frowned.
"I see no need to give him a choice. Of course he has no hint of our true purpose."
"He smelled the scent on the summer air."
Sansa wrinkled her brow. "Our true purpose, milady?"
"He sniffed and roared and smelt it there, honey on the summer air."
"To see you safely wed, child," the old woman said, as Butterbumps bellowed out the old, old song, "to my grandson."
"Wed to Sir Loras? Oh!"
Sansa's breath caught in her throat. She remembered Sir Loras in his sparkling sapphire armour, tossing her a rose. Sir Loras in white silk, so pure, innocent, beautiful, the dimples at the corner of his mouth when he smiled, the sweetness of his laugh, the warmth of his hand. She could only imagine what it would be like to pull up his tunic and caress the smooth skin underneath, to stand on her toes and kiss him, to run her fingers through those thick brown curls, and drown in his deep brown eyes. A flush crept up her neck.
"Oh, I'm a maid, and I'm pure and fair. I'll never dance with a hairy bear, a bear, a bear. I'll never dance with a hairy bear."
"Would you like that, Sansa?" asked Margaery. "I've never had a sister, only brothers. Oh, please say yes. Please say that you will consent to marry my brother." The words came tumbling out of her. "Yes, I will. I would like that more than anything, to wed Sir Loras, to love him."
"Loras?" Lady Olena sounded annoyed. "Don't be foolish, child. Kingsguard never wed. Didn't they teach you anything in Winterfell? We were speaking of my grandson, Willis. He's a bit old for you, to be sure, but a dear boy for all that. Not the least bit oafish, an heir to Highgarden besides."
Sansa felt dizzy. One instant her head was full of dreams of Loras, and the next they had all been snatched away.
"Willis? Willis?"
"Why," she said stupidly.
"Courtesy is a lady's armour. You must not offend them. Be careful what you say."
I do not know, Sir Willis. I've never had the pleasure, my lady. Is he as great a knight as his brothers?"
"Lifted her high into the air, the bear, the bear!"
"No," Marjorie said. "He has never taken vows." Her grandmother frowned. "Tell the girl the truth. The poor lad is crippled, and that's the way of it."
"He was hurt as a squire, riding in his first tourney," Marjorie confided. "His horse fell and crushed his leg."
"That snake of a Dornishman was to blame, that Oberon Martell, and his maester as well.
I call for a knight, but you're a bear, a bear, a bear, all black and brown, and covered with hair."
"Willis has a bad leg, but a good heart," said Marjorie. "He used to read to me when I was a little girl and draw me pictures of the stars. You will love him as much as we do, Sansa."
"She kicked and wailed the maid so fair, but he licked the honey from her hair, her hair, her hair, he licked the honey from her hair."
"When might I meet him?" asked Sansa hesitantly.
"Soon," promised Marjorie, "when you come to Highgarden, after Joffrey and I are wed, my grandmother will take you."
"I will," said the old woman, patting Sansa's hand and smiling a soft, wrinkly smile. "I will indeed."
Then she sighed and squealed and kicked the air. "My bear," she sang, "my bear so fair." And off they went from here to there. The bear, the bear, and the maiden fair.
Butterbumps roared the last line, leapt into the air, and came down on both feet with a crash that shook the wine cups on the table. The women laughed and clapped.
"I thought that dreadful song would never end," said the Queen of Thorns. "Ah, but look, here comes my cheese."
John. Day and night the axes rang. John could not remember the last time he had slept. When he closed his eyes, he dreamed of fighting. When he woke, he fought. Even in the King's Tower, he could hear the ceaseless thunk of bronze and flint and stolen steel biting into wood, and it was louder when he tried to rest in the warming shed atop the wall. Mans had sledgehammers at work as well, and long saws with teeth of bone and flint. Once, as he was drifting off into an exhausted sleep, there came a great cracking from the haunted forest, and a sentinel tree came crashing down in a cloud of dirt and needles. He was awake when Owen came to him, lying restless under a pile of furs on the floor of the warming shed.
"Lord Snow," said Owen, shaking his shoulder, "the dawn."
He gave John a hand to help pull him back onto his feet. Others were waking as well, jostling one another as they pulled on their boots and buckled their sword belts in the close confines of the shed. No one spoke. They were all too tired to talk. Few of them ever left the wall these days. It took too long to ride up and down in the cage. Castle Black had been abandoned to Maester Aemon, Sir Winton Stout, and a few others too old or ill to fight.
"I had a dream that the king had come," Owen said happily. "Maester Aemon sent a raven, and King Robert Clark came with all his strength. I dreamed I saw his golden banners."
John made himself smile. "That would be a welcome sight to see, Owen." Ignoring the twinge of pain in his leg, He swept a black fur cloak about his shoulders, gathered up his crutch, and went out onto the wall to face another day. A gust of wind sent icy tendrils wending through his long brown hair. Half a mile north, the wildling encampments were stirring, their campfires sending up smoky fingers to scratch against the pale dawn sky. Along the edge of the forest, they had raised their tents of hide and fur, even a crude long haul of logs and woven branches. There were horse lines to the east, mammoths to the west, and men everywhere, sharpening their swords, putting points on crude spears, donning makeshift armor of hide and horn and bone. For every man that he could see, John knew there were a score unseen in the wood. The brush gave them some shelter from the elements, and hid them from the eyes of the hated crows. Already their archers were stealing forward, pushing their rolling mantlets. "Here come our breakfast arrows," Pip announced cheerfully, as he did every morning. "It's good he can make a jape of it," John thought. "Someone has to." 3 days ago, one of those breakfast arrows had caught Red Allen of the Rosewood in the leg. You can still see his body at the foot of the wall, if you care to lean out far enough. John had to think that it was better for them to smile at Pip's jest than to brood over Allen's corpse. The mantlets were slanting wooden shields, wide enough for five of the free folk to hide behind. The archers pushed them close, then knelt behind them to loose their arrows through slits in the wood. The first time the wildlings rolled them out, John had called for fire arrows and set a half dozen ablaze, but after that men started covering them with raw hides. All the fire arrows in the world couldn't make them catch now. The brothers even started wagering as to which of the straw sentinels would collect the most arrows before they were done. Dolorous Ed was leading with four, but Othol Yarwick, Tumbajohn, and Wat of Longlake had three apiece. It was Pip who started naming the scarecrows after their missing brothers, too.
"It makes it seem as if there's more of us," he said. "More of us with arrows in our bellies," Gren complained,
but the custom did seem to give his brother's heart, so John let the name stand and the wagering continue. On the edge of the wall, an ornate brass Moorish eye stood on three spindly legs. Maester Aemon had once used it to peer at the stars, before his own eyes had failed him. John swung the tube down to have a look at the foe. Even at this distance there was no mistaking Mance Raider's huge white tent, sewn together from the pelts of snow bears. The Moorish lenses brought the wildlings close enough for him to make out faces. Of Mance himself he saw no sign this morning, but his woman, Dala, was outside tending the fire, while her sister Val milked a she-goat beside the tent. Dala looked so big it was a wonder she could move. "The child must be coming very soon," John thought. He swiveled the eye east and searched amongst the tents and trees till he found the turtle. That will be coming very soon as well. The wildlings had skinned one of the dead mammoths during the night, and they were lashing the raw, bloody hide over the turtle's roof, one more layer on top of the sheepskins and pelts. The turtle had a rounded top and eight huge wheels, and under the hides was a stout wooden frame. When the wildlings had begun knocking it together, Saturn thought they were building a ship. Not far wrong. The turtle was a hull turned upside down and opened fore and aft, a long haul on wheels.
"It's done, isn't it?" asked Gren.
"Near enough." John shoved away the eye. "It will come today, most like. Did you fill the barrels?"
"Every one. They froze hard during the night. Pip checked."
Gren had changed a great deal from the big, clumsy, redneck boy John had first befriended. He had grown half a foot, his chest and shoulders had thickened, and he had not cut his hair nor trimmed his beard since the fist of the first men. It made him look as huge and shaggy as an oryx, the mocking name that Sir Alistair Thorne had hung on him during training. He looked weary now, though. When John said as much, he nodded.
"I heard their axes all night. Couldn't sleep for all the chopping."
"Then go sleep now."
"I don't need. You do.
I want you rested. Go on. I'm not going to let you sleep through the fight. He made himself smile. You're the only one who can move those bloody barrels. Gren went off muttering, and John returned to the far eye, searching the wildling camp. From time to time an arrow would sail past overhead, but he learned to ignore those. The range was long, and the angle was bad. The chances of being hit were small. He still saw no sign of Man's raider in the camp, but espied Tormund Giantsbane and two of his sons around the turtle. The sons were struggling with the mammoth hide, while Tormund gnawed on the roast leg of a goat and bellowed orders. Elsewhere he found the wildling skin-changer, Varamyr Sixskins, walking through the trees with his shadow cat dogging his heels. When he heard the rattle of the winch-chains and the iron groan of the cage door opening, he knew it would be Hub bringing their breakfast as he did every morning. The sight of Mance's turtle had robbed John of his appetite. Their oil was all but gone, and the last barrel of pitch had been rolled off the wall 2 nights ago. They would soon run short of arrows as well, and there were no Fletchers making more. And the night before last, a raven had come from the west, from Sir Dennis Mallister. Bowen Marsh had chased the wildlings all the way to the Shadow Tower, it seemed, and then farther, down into the gloom of the gorge. At the Bridge of Skulls he had met the Weeper and 300 wildlings and won a bloody battle. But the victory had been a costly one. More than 100 brothers slain, among them Sir Andrew Tarth and Sir Allardale Winch. The old pomegranate himself had been carried back to the Shadow Tower, sorely wounded. Maester Mullen was tending him, but it would be some time before he was fit to return to Castle Black. When he had read that, John had dispatched Zay to Molestown on their best horse, to plead with the villagers to help man the wall. She never returned. When he sent Molly after her, he came back to report the whole village deserted, even the brothel. Most likely Zay had followed them, straight down the King's Road. Maybe we should all do the same, John reflected glumly. He made himself eat, hungry or no. Bad enough, he could not sleep. He could not go on without food as well. Besides, this might be my last meal. It might be the last meal for all of us. So it was that John had a belly full of bread, bacon, onions and cheese when he heard Horse shout, "It's coming!" No one needed to ask what it was. Nor did John need the maester's Moorish eye to see it creeping out from amongst the tents and trees. "It doesn't really look much like a turtle," Saturn commented. "Turtles don't have fur." "Most of them don't have wheels either," said Pip. "Sound the war horn," John commanded, and Keggs blew 2 long blasts to wake Gren and the other sleepers who'd had the watch during the night. If the wildlings were coming, the wall would need every man. Gods know we have few enough. John looked at Pip and Keggs and Satin, Horse and Owen the Oaf, Tim Tangletongue, Molly Spareboot and the rest, and tried to imagine them going belly to belly and blade to blade against 100 screaming wildlings in the freezing darkness of that tunnel, with only a few iron bars between them. That was what it would come down to, unless they could stop the turtle before the gate was breached.
"It's big," Horse said.
Pip smacked his lips. "Think of all the soup it will make!" The jape was stillborn. Even Pip sounded tired. "He looks half-dead," John thought. "But so do we all." The king beyond the wall had so many men that he could throw fresh attackers at them every time. But the same handful of black brothers had to meet every assault, and it had worn them ragged. The men beneath the wooden hides would be pulling hard, John knew, putting their shoulders into it, straining to keep the wheels turning. But once the turtle was flush against the gate, they would exchange their ropes for axes. At least Mance was not sending his mammoths today. John was glad of that. Their awesome strength was wasted on the wall, and their size only made them easy targets. The last had been a day and a half in the dying. Its mournful trumpeting was terrible to hear. The turtle crept slowly through stones and stumps and brush. The earlier attacks had cost the free folk 100 lives or more. Most still lay where they had fallen. In the lulls the crows would come and pay them court, but now the birds fled, screeching. They liked the look of that turtle no more than he did. Saturn Horse and the others were looking to him, John knew, waiting for his orders. He was so tired, he hardly knew any more. "The wall is mine," he reminded himself. "Owen, Horse, to the catapults. Kegs, you and Spare Boot on the scorpions. The rest of you, string your bows. Fire arrows. Let's see if we can burn it." It was likely to be a futile gesture, John knew, but it had to be better than standing helpless. Cumbersome and slow-moving, the turtle made for an easy shot, and his archers and crossbowmen soon turned it into a lumbering wooden hedgehog. But the wet hides protected it, just as they had the mantlets, and the flaming arrows gutted out almost as soon as they struck. John cursed under his breath. "Scorpions!" he commanded. "Catapults!" The scorpion's bolts punched deep into the pelts, but did no more damage than the fire arrows. The rocks went bouncing off the turtle's roof, leaving dimples in the thick layers of hides. A stone from one of the trebuchets might have crushed it, but the one machine was still broken, and the wildlings had gone wide around the area where the other dropped its loads. "John Estilkirk coming," said Owen the Oaf. He could see that for himself. Inch by inch, yard by yard, the turtle crept closer, rolling, rumbling, and rocking as it crossed the killing ground. Once the wildlings got it flush against the wall, it would give them all the shelter they needed whilst their axes crashed through the hastily repaired outer gates. Inside, under the ice, they would clear the loose rubble from the tunnel in a matter of hours, and then there would be nothing to stop them but two iron gates, a few half-frozen corpses, and whatever brothers John cared to throw in their path to fight and die down in the dark. To his left, the catapult made a thunk and filled the air with spinning stones. They plunked down on the turtle like hail and caromed harmlessly aside. The wilding archers were still loosing arrows from behind their mantlets. One thudded into the face of a straw man, and Pip said, "Four for Wat of Longlake. We have a tie." The next shaft whistled past his own ear, however. "Fie!" he shouted down. "I'm not in the tourney." "The hides won't burn," John said, as much to himself as to the others. Their only hope was to try and crush the turtle when it reached the wall. For that they needed boulders. No matter how stoutly built the turtle was, a huge chunk of rock crashing straight down on top of it from 700 feet was bound to do some damage. "Gren, Owen, Kegs, it's time." Alongside the warming shed, a dozen stout oaken barrels were lined up in a row. They were full of crushed rock, the gravel that the Black Brothers customarily spread on the footpaths to give themselves better footing atop the wall. Yesterday, after he'd seen the free folk covering the turtle with sheepskins, John told Gren to pour water into the barrels, as much as they would take. The water would seep down through the crushed stone, and overnight the whole thing would freeze solid. It was the nearest thing to a boulder they were going to get.
"Why do we need to freeze it?" Gren had asked him. "Why don't we just roll the barrels off the way they are?"
John answered, "If they crash against the wall on the way down, they'll burst, and loose gravel will spray everywhere. We don't want to rain pebbles on the horses." He put his shoulder to the one barrel with Gren, while Kegs and Owen were wrestling with another. Together they rocked it back and forth to break the grip of the ice that had formed around its bottom.
"The bugger weighs a ton," said Gren.
"Tip it over and roll it," John said. "Careful. If it rolls over your foot, you'll end up like Spare Boot." Once the barrel was on its side, John grabbed a torch and waved it above the surface of the wall, back and forth, just enough to melt the ice a little. The thin film of water helped the barrel roll more easily. Too easily, in fact. They almost lost it. But finally, with four of them pooling their efforts, they rolled their boulder to the edge and stood it up again. They had four of the big oak barrels lined up above the gate by the time Pip shouted, "There's a turtle at our door!" John braced his injured leg and leaned out for a look. Hoardings. Marsh should have built hoardings. So many things they should have done. The wildlings were dragging the dead giants away from the gate. Horse and Molly were dropping rocks down on them, and John thought he saw one man go down. But the stones were too small to have any effect on the turtle itself. He wondered what the free folk would do about the dead mammoth in the path. But then he saw. The turtle was almost as wide as a longhorn. So they simply pushed it over the carcass. His leg twitched, but Horse caught his arm and drew him back to safety.
"You shouldn't lean out like that," the boy said.
"We should have built hoardings." John thought he could hear the crash of axes on wood, but that was probably just fear ringing in his ears. He looked to Gren.
"Do it!"
Gren got behind a barrel, put his shoulder against it, grunted, and began to push. Owen and Molly moved to help him. They shoved the barrel out a foot, and then another, and suddenly it was gone. They heard the thump as it struck the wall on the way down, and then, much louder, the crash and crack of splintering wood, followed by shouts and screams. Satin whooped, and Owen the Oaf danced in circles, while Pip leaned out and called,
"The turtle was stuffed full of rabbits! Look at them hop away!"
"Again!" John barked, and Gren and Keggs slammed their shoulders against the next barrel and sent it tottering out into empty air. By the time they were done, the front of Mansa's turtle was a crushed and splintered ruin, and wildlings were spilling out the other end and scrambling for their camp. Satin scooped up his crossbow and sent a few quarrels after them as they ran, to see them off the faster. Gren was grinning through his beard, Pip was making japes, and none of them would die today. On the morrow, though, John glanced toward the shed. 8 barrels of gravel remained, where 12 had stood a few moments before. He realized how tired he was then, and how much his wound was hurting. "I need to sleep, a few hours at least. He could go to Maester Aemon for some dream wine, that would help.
I'm going down to the King's Tower," he told them. "Call me if Mance gets up to anything. Pip, you have the wall."
"Me?" said Pip.
"Em?" said Gren.
Smiling, he left them to it and rode down in the cage. A cup of dream wine did help, as it happened. No sooner had he stretched out on the narrow bed in his cell than sleep took him. His dreams were strange and formless, full of strange voices, shouts and cries, and the sound of a war horn blowing low and loud, a single deep booming note that lingered in the air. When he awoke, the sky was black outside the arrow slit that served him for a window, and 4 men he did not know were standing over him. One held a lantern.
"John Snow," the tallest of them said brusquely, "pull in your boots and come with us."
His first groggy thought was that somehow the wall had fallen whilst he'd slept, that Man's raider had sent more giants or another turtle and broken through the gate. But when he rubbed his eyes, he saw that the strangers were all in black. "They're men of the Night's Watch," John realized.
"Come where? Who are you?"
The tall man gestured, and 2 of the others pulled John from the bed. With the lantern leading the way, they marched him from his cell and up a half turn of stair to the old bear's solar. He saw Maester Aemon standing by the fire, his hands folded around the head of a blackthorn cane. Septon Celador was half drunk as usual, and Sir Winton Stout was asleep in a window seat. The other brothers were strangers to him, all but one. Immaculate in his fur-trimmed cloak and polished boots, Sir Alistair Thorne turned to say,
"Here's a turncloak now, my lord. Ned Stark's bastard, of Winterfell."
"I'm no turncloak, Thorne," John said coldly.
"We shall see."
In the leather chair behind the table where the old bear wrote his letters sat a big, broad, jowly man John did not know.
"Yes, we shall see," he said again. "You will not deny that you are John Snow, I hope. Stark's bastard. Lord Snow, he likes to call himself.
Sir Alistair was a spare, slim man, compact and sinewy, and just now his flinty eyes were dark with amusement.
You're the one who named me Lord Snow, said John.
Sir Alistair had been fond of naming the boys he trained during his time as Castle Black's master-at-arms. The old bear had sent Thorn to Eastwatch by the sea. These others must be Eastwatch men. The Birdreach cut a pike, and he sent us help.
How many men have you brought? He asked the man behind the table. It's me who'll ask the questions, the jolly man replied. You've been charged with oath-breaking, cowardice, and desertion, John Snow. Do you deny that you abandoned your brothers to die on the fist of the first men, and joined the wildling Mance Rayder, this self-styled king beyond the wall?
Abandon? John almost choked on the word. Maester Aemon spoke up then.
My lord, Donald Noy and I discussed these issues when John Snow first returned to us, and were satisfied by John's explanations.
Well, I am not satisfied, Maester, said the jolly man. I will hear these explanations for myself. Yes, I will.
John swallowed his anger.
I abandoned no one. I left the fist with Corrin Halfhand to scout the Skirling Pass. I joined the wildlings under orders. The Halfhand feared that Mance might have found the Horn of Winter.
The Horn of Winter? Sir Alistair chuckled. Were you commanded to count their snarks as well, Lord Snow?
No, but I counted their giants as best I could.
Sir, snapped the jolly man, you will address Sir Alistair as Sir, and myself as my lord. I am Janus Swint, Lord of Harrenhal, and commander here at Castle Black, until such time as Bourne Marsh returns with his garrison. You will grant us our courtesies, yes? I will not suffer to hear an anointed knight like the good Sir Alistair mocked by a traitor's bastard.
He raised a hand and pointed a meaty finger at John's face.
Do you deny that you took a wildling woman into your bed?
No. John's grief over Ygritte was too fresh for him to deny her now. No, my lord.
I suppose it was also the Halfhand who commanded you to fuck this unwashed whore,
Sir Alistair asked with a smirk.
Sir, she was no whore, sir.
The Halfhand told me not to balk whatever the wildlings asked of me, but I will not deny that I went beyond what I had to do, that I cared for her.
You admit to being an oath-breaker, then, said Janus Slint.
Half the men at Castle Black visited Molestown from time to time to dig for buried treasure in the brothel, John knew, but he would not dishonour Ygritte by equating her with the Molestown whores. I broke my vows with a woman. I admit that, yes.
Yes, my lord.
When Slint scowled, his jowls quivered. He was as broad as the old bear had been, and no doubt would be as bald if he lived to Mormont's age. Half his hair was gone already, though he could not have been more than 40.
Yes, my lord, John said. I rode with the wildlings and ate with them, as the Halfhand commanded me, and I shared my fur regret. But I swear to you, I never turned my cloak. I escaped the Magnar as soon as I could, and never took up arms against my brothers or the realm.
Lord Slint's small eyes studied him.
Sir Glendon, he commanded, bring in the other prisoner.
Sir Glendon was the tall man who had dragged John from his bed. Four other men went with him when he left the room. But they were back soon enough with a captive, a small, sallow, battered man, fettered hand and foot. He had a single eyebrow, a widow's peak, and a moustache that looked like a smear of dirt on his upper lip. But his face was swollen and mottled with bruises, and most of his front teeth had been knocked out. The East Watch men threw the captive roughly to the floor. Lord Slint frowned down on him.
Is this the one you spoke of?
The captive blinked yellow eyes.
Aye.
Not until that instant did John recognize Rattleshirt.
He is a different man without his armor, he thought. Ah, the wildling repeated. He's the craven. Kill Halfhand.